Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. We're so glad you could attend. Come inside, come inside. There behind the glass stands a real blade of...
Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Jack Spencer and our special guest this week, Jeff Timmer, longtime political consultant in this town. Thanks for joining us, Jeff.
I'm glad to be here.
So, Jeff, we're going to be coming into the Democratic debates Tuesday and Wednesday. So, as a political consultant who typically doesn't align with Democrats, do you pay attention to this, or do you tune it out, or what do you do?
I've long paid attention to this, looking at the Democrats and sizing up the opponents over the 30 years I've been in this business. Now I'm watching it more for, is there someone there that I can actually vote for?
So you're actually thinking that there could be somebody on the Democratic stage that you could vote for?
Definitely. I think there could be. Not that I would agree with them on everything or even a lot of things, but it's a binary choice. You know, it's one that I think I'm going to possibly make this year.
So you've been a Republican consultant. You've been working with Republican clients for how long?
Well,
give our listeners a little background on this, because this is a little interesting that you're even considering a Democrat.
Sure. I've been involved in helping elect Republicans in Michigan since 1990. I was the executive director of the Michigan Republican Party for 4 years. The Republican Party that I was part of, that I was happy to have a leadership role in, the party of Reagan conservatism, doesn't exist in today's Republican Party.
So do you consider yourself a Republican?
Not any longer.
Since when?
It's been a gradual process over the last 4 or 5 years. The party has become a cult of personality instead of a party that adheres to ideological values of smaller government, individual liberty, lower taxes, lower spending. It's become a party of, do you support someone who opposes Trump or someone who likes Trump? I mean, it's that simple.
Well, you see, Bill Weld is running as a Republican in this primary, and we also have, John Kasich. You used to work with John Kasich here in Michigan.
I did.
They still identify as Republicans. So you still got to think there's hope for the party, don't you?
I do, and it's not there are good people in the party. What I don't get, Trump is what Trump is. Trump has never pretended to be anything other than what he is. What surprises me, I've long known there were some in the party who are very much like Trump, or that Trump's shtick would appeal to them. But they were on the fringe. They were under the rocks. They've now crawled out into the light and taken control of the narrative. And the people that would identify themselves as Reagan conservative type of Republican has now either put their head down for fear of losing re-election. They've become craven in their fealty to a person instead of an ideology.
So does that mean you support Justin Amash then?
Absolutely.
Okay, so if Justin Amash were to run for president as a Libertarian, you'd give that a hard look.
I would, and I'm a constituent of Justin's. I've had a lot of political differences with him over the years, but on his country over party, there are things that matter more than simply winning, and I support him fully.
Okay, now on the Republican side, as far as Trump not being in the tradition of Reagan, the kind of issues that come into my mind would basically be things like particularly trade. Is that the kind of thing that you're talking about, that you think they've wandered, the Republican Party has wandered way off course?
Trade, national security, foreign policy, government spending, and I'm talking about the kind of philosophy that's existed in the Republican Party since Reagan. I understand the deficits and debt that accrued under Reagan with the Democrat Congress. For the last 30, 40 years, the pillar of the Republican Party has been control spending, control deficits, bring down the national debt. And I mean, there's not a Republican out there that talks about that with any seriousness.
Okay, I'm going to be a little bit of a devil's advocate on this. My perception of that whole thing has been the Democrats don't even talk about it hardly ever. They don't even acknowledge the deficit. The Republicans talk about it, but then never do anything about it.
That's not precisely true. I mean, they have done things about it. John Kasich, for example, when he was the chairman of the Budget Committee at the end of Clinton's term and before he left Congress, actually left George W. Bush with a balanced budget, with a surplus. in the last 2 years of Clinton's term. Now, that was a bipartisan deal. It's forgotten in the aftermath of September 11th and the deficits that accrued because of the increase in military spending over the first decade of this century.
Was there anything that Donald Trump said or tweeted that kind of drove you over the edge?
Well, if you look back, I actually looked at this, however many thousands of tweets he's had since he came down the escalator in 2015. And there's an actual psychological term for that. Every one of those tweets can fall under the term gibbering, barking madness. That's the official psychological term. And so I would say that virtually everything he's uttered in the last 4 years would fall under that.
So you mentioned at the beginning of the podcast that there may be a Democrat that you're inclined to possibly support. What would that Democrat have to say on the debate stage to appeal to you as a passionate independent?
I will stand up to Russia. I will oppose Donald Trump.
What about fiscal policy? Because I haven't heard any fiscal policy from these Democratic candidates. I've heard a lot of spending. I haven't heard a lot about trying to even remotely balance the budget.
That's why I would say I'm independent. I'm not a Democrat, but if the choice is between Donald Trump and Joe Biden, for instance, the choice is clear. If it's a choice between Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, I can't vote for Bernie Sanders. Mm-hmm. I could vote for a Libertarian candidate. I could write in somebody's name. I could choose not to vote at all in that race. But, I've made this choice before in the 2018 election. I was happy to vote for Gretchen Whitmer, though I didn't agree with her on a lot of things.
You did vote for Gretchen Whitmer, and why is that? Because Bill Schuette was endorsed by Trump?
There were a variety of reasons. I thought the party had made some grave strategic errors in trying to align themselves more closely with Trump as the election was drawing near, and the evidence on the wall was that was a strategy that was doomed for failure, and that was very clear in the outcome of the election.
So switching gears here a little bit, this may come as a surprise to folks who are listening that Jeff Timmer would be aligned more as an independent now, considering you had such a hand in the crafting of the 2011 legislative and congressional redistricting boundaries, and you were very involved in that. Now that this case is kind of done and gone, what's been your thinking as to how this thing unfolded, and do you think that you were treated fairly in this?
No, I mean, it's a political process. The lawsuit was a political lawsuit. It was surprising when it came about, given the lateness in the decade. It was anticipated and it would have been expected that there would have been a lawsuit filed prior to the 2012 election, or certainly more proximate to the census. I've been involved in redistricting since 1991. This last cycle was my third go around, and it, especially in 2001 and again in 2011, everyone liked to say, well, look at this, Republican gerrymander to the legislative maps, the congressional maps. I remember hearing that after the 2002 elections with the state legislature, with the House and Senate. And by 2006, the Democrats were sitting in control in the state House. And, those predictions looked pretty foolish. The 9-5 solid Republican majority that everyone thought happened with the congressional districts this last go around, we're now sitting at 7-7, and we could very conceivably be at 5 Republicans by the time this election cycle is over, if Fred Upton were to lose or retire and that seat were to flip, and if Justin Amash were to win re-election, that would leave 5 Republicans in the delegation.
So you don't think that, let me just kind of backtrack here, because during the course of this trial, there was a lot made of some email exchanges, mm-hmm. Some directed at you concerning packing all the Democratic quote-unquote trash into mm-hmm. certain districts. Now, isn't that evidence or isn't that proof that the folks who were making these maps were of this mindset, that this is what we had to do?
No, because in the particular instance there, those were folks who were trying to influence the process and sending unsolicited emails. And that was Thad McCotter and his chief of staff, who were far more concerned with a district that Thad McCotter could win, not a Republican district, but one that excluded certain personalities from being in a primary against him. And I said that during the trial.
So that was more about Thad McCotter trying to protect Thad McCotter, when really he should have been more worried about the staff under him collecting signatures.
Well, yeah, Thad McCotter or his staff had a Rolodex of personalities they didn't want in his congressional district. And if you look at how some of the exchanges, there was a reason Marty Nolenberg didn't reside in Thad McCotter's district. There's a reason certain people, Mike Bishop and others, didn't reside in Thad McCotter's district.
Is this the kind of thing you'd expect to end under the commission? This idea, not as much the Republican-Democrat breakdown in terms of the districts, but the things that are actually within a party, one person being avoided in another person's district, et cetera. Is that the kind of thing the commission might eliminate?
Perhaps, though there's going to be those same kind of dynamics that do exist as people look and receive information, say at public hearings, there's going to be consideration given. The fact that Michigan changed its constitution in process and way the districts are drawn doesn't preclude adherence to Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, for instance, which would talk about or be concerned about regression of the number of majority black districts in the state of Michigan. The impact of maps on, say, Brenda Lawrence and the district represented by Rashida Tlaib have to be taken into account under the Federal Voting Rights Act and many court cases since. And so the impact of personality and people will still be part of the process.
One of the things I've been curious about in that whole potential map drawing is I understand the idea of the majority-minority districts, mm-hmm. But wouldn't there be a way to do it so instead of being a 95% Democratic district, it simply falls to a 65% Democratic district?
Perhaps, though I think you need to get into, without getting too into the weeds here on redistricting, you'd have to really contrive the borders for that to happen because of how people who historically vote Democrat are concentrated geographically, concentrated in certain areas, in this instance, Detroit and close-in suburbs that are heavily Democrat. You'd have to really take and think of Detroit as like a spoke and have these long, thin, twisting, winding, snaking districts that go way out into the exurbs and rural areas to achieve that kind of dilution of Democrat votes. I mean, that would be the cracking that they talk about as opposed to the packing, which is doesn't necessarily mean that there was something nefarious going on. It was just adhering to the criteria of county borders and municipal borders and reflecting where people live.
So are you guessing there might be a certain amount of disappointment with how this turns out in some quarters?
Well, I think there could be, especially when this notion that this is an independent citizens commission. A majority of members of this commission are partisans. By definition, there's four Republicans and four Democrats on this commission, so that's 8 out of 13 who are acknowledged, declared partisans. Mm-hmm. And so that partisan perspective is going to be the majority on this independent commission. I think the marketing of this exceeds the reality of this.
So when we are done with the maps and done with this process, do you expect maps that are going to, where folks are going to look at this and say, oh, wow, we have bipartisanship. I mean, this is what they should have looked like all along.
Absolutely not. That hasn't happened in California. That hasn't happened in Iowa. Other states where they've had independent commissions, the same kind of accusations are lobbed by those who view themselves as coming out on the short end.
So we could have a lot of disappointment here.
Absolutely. It's an inherently political process that people are trying to remove politics from. It's an irrational approach. It is politics. It's electing people who represent, by and large, a partisan political party. It's been a long time since Michigan's elected independence to anything.
So are you saying then that the maps that you helped draw in 2011 and 2001, they were all partisan in the fact that they were drawn to advantage the Republicans?
No, I'm saying that there are certain inherent factors in Michigan and the criteria and based on where people live that cause that to happen beyond partisans wanting it to happen. What people don't understand, and it doesn't matter any longer, is that the historical criteria of preserving county and municipal boundaries leads to the kinds of maps that we've had. Democrats are concentrated in certain urban and close suburban areas to those urban cores, and Republicans exist in larger numbers in a more diffuse across the state. And so drawing boundaries that adhere primarily to county boundaries is going to lead to the kinds of maps that we've had. And so the only way to draw districts that people would consider more politically fair, in quotation marks, would be to ignore those historical boundaries of counties, cities, and townships.
And is that realistic? Because are the courts going to buy it if this commission steps forward and says we're going to get rid of the eight poll standards? Aren't they going to have a pretty strong argument for something else, or the courts aren't going to buy it?
I would think so, but if you look at the language that they put into this amendment that's now in the Constitution, they have other criteria now in the Constitution that rate far higher than those geographic boundaries.
Like communities of interest.
And what is that? They don't define it. Nobody defines it. It's you know, that's like pornography, you know, that old definition. You know it when you see it, and it's in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah. But isn't that what the community input is supposed to be for? We go out in these communities and they decide, okay, well, this is actually a community. And then when you get across the road here, this is more rural and things kind of change at this point. I mean, it's getting in touch with a particular community that may not be defined by a political boundary.
Again, it's going to be defined. There's going to be 10 million. If you sat down with the 10 million people in Michigan, every one of them would have a different perspective on exactly what that means.
And that's the problem.
That's
with this.
The problem. It there isn't an objective criteria where there has been. People might not like it. It might not yield the perfect result, but it was objective. It was the geographic boundaries that the state has legally divided itself into. Now we're going to be coming up with a nebulous subjective criteria to divide ourselves into.
So what do you expect these maps to look like in 2021?
I think they're going to look largely similar in shape, at least. There's going to be square districts and there's going to be snaking districts. There's going to be things that people like and things that people hate, and that's going to favor one party and disadvantage another. And I think it's going to end up in court before, during, and after the election, and as these things tend to do.
All right, Jeff Timmer, before I let you go here, you know, you're still a political consultant, right?
Yes, I am. Two Rivers Public Affairs is my company, and I will gladly work with and for candidates who I think are honorable people of integrity. I wouldn't say that all the Republicans in the state are spineless. I will say that many of them have severe scoliosis.
Are those the Red Cedar and the Grand? Are those the two?
That's the Grand and the Looking Glass.
Ah, okay.
Yes. Yeah, we're getting over in by Ionia County,
yeah,
Portland, right?
In Portland, yes.
Yeah. Jeff Timmer, thanks for making it over to MERS World Headquarters. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Kyle.
Joining us on the other end of the line is former Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper. He's one of the presidential candidates who is going to be on the stage in the great city of Detroit. Thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
Thank you so much.
So some of our listeners may be familiar that you got into business as a brew pub owner. And obviously here in Michigan, we're very proud of our brew pubs. So the first thing I wanted to ask you, first off, are you familiar with any of the Michigan breweries? And do you have a favorite Michigan microbrew?
You know, it's funny. I opened back in 1988, and I always had a particular affection for Bell's up in Kalamazoo. I knew Larry Bell back in the day, and he had a table tent. Back then, all your bartenders and wait staff were all pierced. They had pierced tongues, pierced ears, pierced noses. And he had a table tent that said, Bell's India Pale Ale. Flavor so intense it pierces the palate without that ugly metal taste. Anyway, so he's got a beer out now called Double Heart, which we tried last night when we got in. So, and it was delicious. Just, he always has made great beers.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Bell's. So are you in Michigan now?
Yeah, I'm in Detroit, the Motor City.
When's the last time you've been to Michigan before now?
I came out about a month ago during the campaign. The NAACP was here.
Okay.
And they asked me to come up and speak, which I did. And I spent the afternoon and talked to some people. And, you know, I have to say that there's a whole different vibe around Detroit now. When I came out here previously, people seemed to be hanging their heads and there wasn't much optimism. Whereas now I think there's a whole different sense around the city. It's great to see.
Yeah, what do you make of that? What do you make of the kind of the revitalization of Detroit? That's got to be kind of exciting to see. And kind of as far as we're concerned here, we're kind of at the back end of this, but this is a lot of urban renewal that we're seeing in our Midwestern cities, and we're happy to see Detroit's finally catching up.
Well, that's how I got into politics. You know, I was a geologist and got laid off, and I opened what eventually became the largest brew pub in the country in 1988 in lower downtown Denver when the rent was $1 per square foot per year. That's how abandoned it was. And we created that same kind of urban revitalization. And after 15 years in the restaurant business, I got talked into running for mayor. I'd never run for student council. And I wanted to revitalize the entire city of Denver, and I did that over 8 years. And then as governor, you know, when I got elected governor in 2010, I became the first Denver mayor in 120 years to get elected governor of Colorado. And I mean, that's just a reflection of the age-old animosity to the city by all the rural areas. But we transformed. We went from 40th in job creation to becoming the number one economy in the country over the last 3 years. And it's the same basic principles that we use in the city of Denver. You know, you get rid of the red tape and bureaucracy that slows things down, provide better access to capital. You really celebrate innovation and entrepreneurs. And you basically change people's attitudes to make people feel, well, we're going to be the most pro-business state in the country, but with the highest environmental standards, the highest ethical standards. You know, we're going to make this city and this state something that everyone is proud of.
Well, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, too, and then after or while you were in Colorado, you had to deal with legalized marijuana, and maybe deal with isn't maybe the best word to put it, but you weren't in support of legalized marijuana. We just legalized marijuana here in Michigan in our last election, and I wanted to see if you had any advice for us or our policy leaders on how to make that transformation from legalized medical marijuana, which we have had for about 10 years, to legalize recreational marijuana.
Well, you know, I opposed it because I was worried that we'd have a spike in teenage consumption by legalizing it. But, you know, we took some of the tax money and did TV ads to make sure, you know, kids understood that while their brains are rapidly growing, so up until the age of 23 or 24, kids shouldn't really even consider using this high THC marijuana. It's just they shouldn't do it. Every 2 years, we do a survey of 24,000 Colorado residents. So we have a real good indication of whether people increase usage or not. And it turns out that over, you know, the 6 years since we've legalized it, there's been no spike in consumption in any demographic age group, with the exception of senior citizens. Anyway, to cut to the chase, you know, I would tell states and other governors that they should make sure they have a really good database-based level. In other words, make sure you know what your consumption is so that you can track if you've got problems. And I think you've got to make sure that you have be prepared for these things like the, you know, marijuana candy. We banned the industry from making high THC-infused candy, different types of candy that would be so attractive to kids that, you know, we had 5-year-olds and 10-year-olds in the emergency rooms when we first passed the law. So, I mean, that's the basics. But I think everybody knows that. You know, we were the first state in America to legalize recreational marijuana. We're the first. I mean, literally, even Copenhagen had never legalized it. They just decriminalized it. We were the first place to really regulate it. And, you know, there's no question that the old system, I mean, we still have problems with legalized marijuana, but it's nowhere near what the old system was, where we sent hundreds of thousands, millions of kids, mostly kids of color, and sent them to prison. We made them felons for a victimless crime. This is still hard. I mean, Colorado is a lot of work, but it's a much better system than the old one.
One of the things that kind of struck me as I was looking at the Democratic field is that we also have U.S. Senator Michael Bennett from your great state of Colorado in the race. And I wasn't familiar with this until this weekend when I did a little research that he was actually part of your team. How did this happen that we have two folks then from Colorado and someone that you worked with in the past both jump into the race?
Well, it's so funny, right, that he was my chief of staff when I first got elected mayor. And I didn't know anything about politics, whereas he'd grown up in Washington, and he really understood how politics worked. So he was a great help when I first got elected, and it was my idea that he go off and become superintendent of schools, and he became a great superintendent. And then when he got appointed senator, Ken Salazar went to become Secretary of the Interior. You know, he's been in the Senate now for 10 years, and I think both of us independently had made our minds up and were thinking about it and working towards it. And you know, the funny thing is, you know, also we went to the same college together.
So oh, wow.
I knew his father. I also knew his father because his father was president of that college. So I knew his father before I knew him. Anyway, we are old friends. He's one of the smartest people I know. And he's running, you know, for different reasons than I am. And I think it says a lot about Colorado that we're the only, you know, the only Western state that has two of their favorite sons running for president.
So there's no animosity then between you, because that was the first thing I thought of. Well, maybe they've got some kind of long-seated rivalry or something.
Oh, yeah. Michael Bennett's one of the smartest people you'll ever meet. We have very different histories, right? He's been in the Senate for all these years, and I was an entrepreneur. I built restaurants. I built 15 different brew pubs, mostly across the Midwest in abandoned downtowns, and then I was a mayor for 8 years. I was a governor for 8 years. I mean, he's more from Washington, and I'm more from, I guess I'd say my experience is more based in Colorado.
So you're going to be on the stage, obviously, with nine other Democrats. What's the big message that you want viewers to take away from John Hickenlooper on the debate stage? I mean, clearly you're only going to get, you know, 5, 6, 7 minutes or whatever of airtime, but what's the message you really hope people walk away with?
I hope at the end of the debate people say, you know, John Hickenlooper is the one guy that could beat Donald Trump in Michigan. This is a guy who's actually walked the talk, both as a small business owner, but as a mayor and as a governor. He beat the NRA with tough gun laws. He expanded health care coverage and reproductive rights. He created the number one economy in the country for 3 years. I mean, he's delivered on healthcare, on climate change, on jobs, and the things that matter to Americans. He's the one guy who's actually done what everyone else is talking about.
And kind of going off that here then, as far as connecting with folks in the Midwest, is it that kind of that moderate message then that you hope resonates? Or would you even use the word moderate?
Well, you know, I think I'm as progressive as anybody else. I just have a different way of going about it. You know, in the restaurant business, you learn, you know, the lessons of a small business. You learn teamwork and service. And we use those entrepreneurial approaches when I became mayor. And after 2.5 years, Time Magazine called me one of the top 5 big city mayors in America. And when I ran for governor, and people said, no, the mayor of Denver will never win governor. It hasn't happened in 120 years. I ran for governor on that commitment that I've not just helped the urban part of the state, but I changed the economy in the entire state. And so, you know, for the last 3 years, U.S. News and World Report ranks Colorado the number one economy in the country. But they also rank our rural economy one of the top in the country. So, you know, we gave tax incentives for entrepreneurs to start businesses in rural parts of the state. Next year will be the first state in America to have broadband in every city and town in the entire state of Colorado. I think that stuff should matter to people in Michigan, that, you know, that here's someone who can – he's going to run for president, and he's funny, and he understands beer. But he also, he's walked the talk. You know, he's delivered the goods. He knows how to create jobs. He knows how to create opportunity and lower health care costs. He's done it. He's not just talking about it. He's done it.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you also your philosophy on Twitter and Facebook. Obviously, Donald Trump has found this medium and has really worked it to dominate the public discourse. What's your thoughts on the use of Twitter in the modern political landscape?
Well, I mean, Twitter is a tool to address people. It's another form of media, no different than radio or TV, except that it's different in that it's got a limited amount of characters, so it has to be very, very essential. And I think almost all the Democrats are learning how to use Twitter now, right? It's not. Mm-hmm. And now Donald Trump is very good at it because he uses Twitter as a wedge to divide not just his opponents but the entire country. Because I think that covers up how he's failed to deliver on one promise after another to the American people, right? In almost every single thing he promised to deliver, he hasn't delivered. And instead, he just attacks everyone on Twitter and creates so much commotion that people get distracted and divided.
Do you think that in using Twitter and on the Democratic side, it seems like it's been a tool for the far left? Do you have any concerns that through this primary process that the party is moving too left and that there is a concern that come the general election, it's going to be disconnected from the political middle and the independents in this country?
Yes, somewhat. I mean, Twitter does seem to be a particular value to people with extreme views on both sides of every issue. But I think that draws a sharp contrast, and you certainly see people going deeper in other media. In other words, Twitter is the kind of the shouting in the room. But there are an awful lot of people that are still looking deeper into the issues. And I'm ever the optimist. I think that's going to, that enough people are going to, turn the page and read into some of the failures of the Trump administration to make sure that we beat him.
We just got a minute or just one question left here. And I got to ask, because as I've talked to a friends and family member, and I mentioned I'm going to talk to John Hickenlooper, I get a John Hicken what? And, when I grew up, my last name is Malin. So I got some real crazy nicknames when I was in school. The one I remember most is Melon Balls, because you look at my name and you think my last name is Melon, but it's really Malin. So I was called Melon Balls growing up. When you were in school, what was the craziest name that people would call John Hickenlooper?
Oh, there were plenty, man. I mean, they call me Chicken Cooper, or they call me Poopin' Scooper. You have a name like Hickenlooper, you have to put up with all kinds of stuff.
Well, I think you, from reading up on your history, I think you get the last laugh, because it sounds like you've got a very prestigious history with your ancestors having fought in the Revolutionary War on your mom's side and the Civil War on your dad's side. So it sounds like you've got a name to be proud of.
Yeah, I am. It's funny. I never knew any of that stuff about my mother's family or my father's family when I was a kid. My dad got sick when I was pretty young and passed away when I was 8. And no one really talked about his side of the family. But it was amazing. His grandfather, my great-grandfather, was one of the youngest generals in the history of the U.S. military. He built all the bridges on Sherman's march to the sea. He dug the tunnel in the siege of Vicksburg when they blew up the ramparts. I mean, he did all these amazing things and became a general when he was 28 years old. That's amazing. Well, I mean, what a person.
That's really cool. John Hickenlooper, former governor of the state of Colorado and now one of the Democratic candidates for the presidency. Thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
You bet. It was really a treat. Nice talking to you.
Well, thanks for making the trip over here, Jeff, and thanks to Jack. Also, thank you to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. That's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. I'm Kyle Malin. Till next week, take care.